Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Nate here. I've had a few delays with uploading some episodes this last month, but I just wanted to let everyone know that we're still going strong and that you'll get a few new episodes weekly for the next couple weeks. I also wanted to start out this particular show with an exciting announcement. Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk have been hard at work at their upcoming book, as we all know, but another one of their projects they've been working on is a live seminar series. And as it turns out, this live seminar is actually happening next year, Sunday, February 19th. I think it's the week after Super Bowl. So it's the first of a series of seminars that they're creating called True to Life, which is sort of organized around the theme of freedom in an unfree world revisited. And now, for those of you who are members of the Living Wisdom Library, they got news of this and they've actually sold out the in-person tickets. There were very few to go around. However, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk will be live streaming the event, so you can attend virtually. The website to register is www.truetolife.us. So head on over there. Let's register. I'm going to be there. We're going to be trying to get this thing to work, and let's show Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk our support. All right, that's the only announcement I wanted to give you today. Let's get back to this week's show. This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, welcome back. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, except Jen was just making comments about...
Those are in the past. Those comments are in the past. We're moving on.
We're moving on. Okay. All right. Nope. I think I'm doing well. Everything is good.
we'll leave this to people to speculate on what the hell we were talking about pre-show. It gets weird in here, you guys.
Yeah, it does get weird in here. Oh, I have to. I'm feeling moved to make a comment. So a few Beat Your Genes ago. Somebody asked a question about, it was about some mating question. And I talked about how sort of mimicking the sequence from Philip Seymour Hoffman in Almost Famous, where he talks about you know, art and everything is all about the problem of okay looking guys trying to get more attractive females. That's why they do what they do. And so I was talking about, I said something like, you know, that's what essentially my life process has been. Certainly I can see down through the genes, even when I'm not conscious of it. This is what a huge part of the drive for achievement is about. I mean, it could be about general village status seeking and resource acquisition, but a huge part of it that's sitting, you know, semi-consciously, sometimes fully consciously, and sometimes unconsciously. When I go to the gym and I'm trying to, you know, beat some guy, you know, in a one-on-one contest or in a basketball game, what's sitting behind that is the status that might be conferred upon me by females when they hear about the vetting of what happened on the hunt and how much better I did than him. So this is, as I was telling sort of that story that I had completely forgotten about, by the way, I made a throwaway comment. I said, how do you think I wound up with four worthless stepchildren?
Aww.
Okay. And the thing is that my wonderful best friend in life, Melissa, whose children they are, she heard this, and it hurt her feelings.
Wasn't too happy about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, it was
they're not worthless.
No, not at all. So it was just a throwaway line, and I was just sort of making the point that this is. that it's almost a joke point of, look what burden I was willing to carry in order to be in this relationship. And so, but it was just goofy hyperbole, and I absolutely did not mean it. So this is sort of my apology to Melissa for just being sloppy about that, because no, that isn't how I feel at all. I feel blessed to have been integrated in this little family. So anyway, I wanted to get that said.
Well,
there you go. Well,
that's all right. Gentlemanly of you, Dr. Lyle.
And well, I think sort of necessary.
We might hear.
Sounds like he was in a doghouse. So.
Well, we might hear that episode coming up because I'm a little bit behind on posting. Split up that worthless part and just have four children, stepchildren.
No, it actually had. It's already been aired because she heard it.
Oh, okay.
So it might have been from 6 weeks ago or so. All right.
Okay.
All right. So that's that. So with that little job done, we're moving on.
Very good. All right.
Good.
Well,
good.
What's going on in your world, Dr. Hawk? We know what's going on in Dr. Lyle's world.
It's getting cold.
It sounds like a lot of trouble. Yeah, it just seems to keep getting colder.
Yeah.
It's really weird. Yeah.
Guess what? It's not even December yet. I mean, it's not even winter.
It's halfway through December.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how cold you think it's going to get right around mid-February.
Yeah, well, I was here last February, and I do, you know, have some memory of it. I've just really suppressed it.
Suppressed it.
Traumatized.
Well,
yeah, exactly. It's too traumatic to remember, so yeah.
Well, but we will, hopefully this February doesn't get any worse than it was last February, because what we've got cooking is a seminar that we're going to be doing, and it's going to be near Jen, because Jen's the one with the dog children. So
the special needs dogs.
They're not worthless.
Needs dog. No, they're not even close to worthless. In fact, they're invaluable. But anyway,
yeah.
Point is, we're going to be doing
even
this.
Even Doug likes my dogs. That's how good they are.
Yeah, that's saying something, boy. But anyway, but we're going to do this. This is the inaugural. Jen, you just take
inaugural.
Over.
Inaugural.
There.
Yes, this is our, we came up with this new idea, and it was based on a couple of different things, but mostly the fact that we haven't seen each other in person in forever, since COVID, basically. And we certainly haven't done an event together since COVID. Last time we did anything together, any kind of talk in person, was in Australia, which was, you know, nearly 3 years ago. So we've been wanting to spend some time in person, both to work on the book and just, you know, we wanted to do some kind of event, and we came up with this crackpot scheme to basically just give an in-person lecture. And for this first iteration, we didn't want to go too big because we had no idea how many people are going to want to come in person. And so we rented a house where we can really only have about 15 people. And those spots are all spoken for. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes.
That we've already filled those? Yeah.
Yeah.
So we don't have any in-person spots left, but we do have unlimited virtual attendance possible, because we'll be streaming a half day's worth of lectures. So we are going to, we're putting together as we speak some new talks that we've never given before, and we'll give several of them throughout the day, starting at about 10 a.m. and going to 3 p.m. So it's you know, a pretty full day of us going over new ideas and having interactive Q&A with both the audience there and the virtual audience that logs in, and we'll stream the whole thing. And you can sign up anytime at truetolife.us. That's the pitch, I think. Right?
That's it. That's our pitch.
Anything more to say? Yeah.
Yes. TrueToLife.us.
True to Life series.
Yeah.
And
true
so we.
TrueToLife.us. I'm going to make sure that in our description notes. So.
Good.
Yeah, and currently all that website does is it points to the registration page for the Zoom competitor that we're using for this thing. So it's not like a real website with any major info on it. It's just the registration page. So if you want more information about it, you can email us. But, you know, basically all there is to know is that we'll be doing this, and we hope to do more. This is a little bit of an experiment to see how it goes and see if people are interested, and we'll figure out how to improve it as we go. But we're really excited to be doing, you know, something that actually involves seeing each other in person and seeing other people. Like, what a concept.
Yep. It should be a lot of fun. This is essentially it's sort of not dissimilar to when we would lecture at True North Health Center. And so a nice, small, intimate audience where people can ask us questions right in the middle of our sentence, you know, and they, we've got a that I'll have a whiteboard so that I can explain things in more detail and sometimes a better way than I can do just answering questions out in the air. And we get to watch people and watch people's reactions and see when where people are confused. This is just it's a way more interesting and fun way to do things. So it's going to be great. It's going to be a grand scheme. And there'll be 10 a.m. Eastern that we're trying to hit a thing where unfortunately it'll take, God, I hope it's, of course, it's probably Super Bowl Sunday, John. We didn't think of that.
It's usually earlier.
No, I think
usually this is going to be February 19th. We should have said that.
February
19th is a Sunday, but I think Super Bowl Sunday is usually earlier.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So it's shameful that if I'm correct about that, it's really you should just hang your head.
It's the week after Super Bowl Sunday.
Is that right? Oh, yeah. Good.
So if you let your spouse do the Super Bowl thing, they have to let you do this.
There you go. All good. All right.
That's good.
Cool.
With note to self, we should have looked that up.
Yeah, we did, but we got away with it. How about that? All right, Nathan, let's just take questions and see how we do.
Okay, very good. Well, dear doctors, do people feel disgust for themselves when they are a minority in a village? Like you've said, disgust evolved not just out of a sense of right and wrong, but also out of infection and threat. So my question is, do racial, sexual, etc., other minorities suffer because their internal audience will be in tune with the majority community's sense of disgust and or threat around them? How important is it to have people who look, think, love, and are like you for your own self-esteem?
Yeah, very sophisticated, very good question. I would have a few different thoughts about that, but Jen, just what leaps to mind for you?
Yeah, what first comes to mind is that it's a bit of a conceptual leap to go straight to disgust for subjective experience just because you're an outsider. So, you know, there's a whole big literature in political science about identity categories and when and under what conditions any given identity category that you might have claim to becomes, in political science lingo, salient. You know, when is there is some kind of ethnic identity or sexual identity or any of these sort of differences that are being suggested by this question, you might possess that in contrast to the other people around you, and it might make you a quote-unquote outsider, but it might not be a particularly salient aspect of who it is that you are or how people are relating to you. So I don't think somebody's going to be experiencing any sort of self-disgust from their internal audience unless they are getting feedback from the people around them that they are disgusting. You wouldn't develop that in a vacuum just because you notice that you might have some differences with the people in the village around you. So if there is, if the cultural consensus of the village has highlighted that difference as salient for whatever reason that has happened, and some of those are going to be more likely than others given the evolutionary stakes behind them, the village is then communicating or signaling to you that is the cause of your outsider status, and that it is something that is attached to some sort of feeling of shame or infection risk or contagion or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then I could see some shame feelings developing out of that. But mostly I think the experience is just going to be one of confusion and maybe some anger and maybe a desire to change or to hide those characteristics of yourself. But not so much disgust. That seems like not the first place I would go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's great. I'm trying to put my self in those shoes, and I can imagine that a sense of trepidation and anxiety, for example, let's suppose, you know, that is like, and kind of, it would be unlikely that in almost any situation that there would be a uniform negative, you know, negative reaction from people, but it might be a lot. It might be a high percentage. So in other words, you are aware that you are at social risk. You can imagine a young black person walking into a store in 1955 in Alabama, you know what I mean, to get some flour, and not knowing what was going to be on the other side of that door, and what you were going to be putting up with from the clerk, you know, what the other people in the store were going to think about you touching the flour, etc. So you can see that it wouldn't be. It's a long ways to get to, as Jen would say, not only disgust, but turning that disgust, you know, back onto yourself just because you're getting negative feedback from other people. It's more likely that what would happen would you would have anxiety. And then when you got some solidarity support from other people about it, you'd feel anger. In other words, the sort of the deep cost-benefit analysis of what could or should be done, you would start inferring that you were being treated unfairly. But when you were a solitary creature, you would be aware that it was unfair, but you probably wouldn't feel anger because the deep CB of the system would be essentially telling you that you should be submissive because you're in danger.
As much as possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also kind of worth thinking this through. I mean, it's an interesting question because it's not really a Stone Age question, because you would really have this situation in a Stone Age village.
Yes.
There is no outsider in the midst of a Stone Age village that is only an outsider because of some kind of identity category like this. If there's an outsider in the village, it's because nobody knows them. It's because, like, who the hell are you and where did you come from? And yeah, maybe your skin color is a little different, or you talk a little different, or, you know, there are these visual cues, but fundamentally we're signaling you all of the threats and all of the disgust that we have for you because you're not one of us at any level. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to happen if you've somehow wandered your way in, and you know, it's like we could come up with scenarios under which that's going to happen, but you're not an innate member of the community who just has these differences and has these feelings as a result of them. That's not a scenario that unfolds in a Stone Age context. Maybe with, you know, sexual differences and sexual preference differences.
Yeah.
But the community is going to have some way of managing that and understanding that and categorizing you. And there might be some shame attached to that, and some disgust and some embarrassment. Mm-hmm. It's just going to vary from, you know, cultural tradition to cultural tradition. So, this is really more of a modern life scenario, I think.
There absolutely would be. So great question. Yeah. I think they're sniffing around trying to see about the sort of self-esteem impact. If we moved it slightly off disgust, but just sort of a self-esteem impact of feeling less worthy, you know what I'm saying, not equal, and et cetera. What would that look like? And you could see that what that is, it isn't so much disgust, but you're going to be getting signals. If you're experiencing some kind of prejudice and rejection, what you're going to be getting is it isn't going to be a self-disgust, it's going to be a lack of self-confidence. That you're going to feel the anxiety that you can't compete and you're not welcome to compete. And in fact, you're already losing some very important decision-making esteem judgments on the part of the marketplace. And again, it's more anxiety and then anger behind unfairness. If you can get there, if you've got enough strength and solidarity behind you that you can get there. So, but otherwise the reaction should be one of anxiety, submissiveness, and trying to be as undetectable as possible.
That, and the implication in the question here is that, you know, is having people who look and think and are like you important for self-esteem? The flip side of that, you know, kind of looking at your outsider status and feeling like you can't compete at that level, is also not having people you can compare yourself to and therefore estimate your competitive status relative to peers. And so it's not just that you're not you're not welcome in the established group. And that contributes to its own sort of set of feelings that are pretty unpleasant. But it's also the ceiling for your self-esteem is also limited because there's no aspirational yardstick. There's no like, where do I fit into my group? I don't have a group. So I just have this kind of vacuum of feedback from my internal audience, then all that it's telling me is that I can't compete in this particular marketplace.
Yeah.
And that's not a, those are not good feelings.
Right. I just came up with a scheme that it's not like I haven't had moments of this. And probably most people have, you know, Brad Pitt probably hasn't, but most people have had little moments where your strengths and your value is either not being valued or is not known, and you're being like, I can think of times about being sort of outclassed in a basketball gym, and feeling like, and you're feeling less than, low confidence, not respected, but part of me is feeling like, yeah, I'm the only guy with a doctor's degree in this place. Okay.
Yeah. Don't you people know who I am?
Yeah. Totally. Okay. And so you're judging me on one, you know, on one dimension here, and I'm essentially being rejected in a sense. Okay. And so you can feel the lower confidence, and from my standpoint, you could feel the irritation. Anger would be too big of a word for it. I'm thinking about a nerdy, smart kid walking by a table, which is, I'm sure it's either been me or I've seen it, you know, in a lunchroom at a high school, and the cool kids in the Letterman's jackets might even joke about him when he's walking by, like, oh, there goes Poindexter. Okay. Actually, I've seen that kind of thing happen to Alan, but you know, Alan was big and strong and handsome enough, and he actually would elicit those comments because as he's walking past, they can see the arrogance in him. You know what I mean? And so there would be snickering and insults, but Alan being Alan, he really was impervious. But you can imagine the bullying psychology that's involved there would do that to some kid who is just some shy little kid with his big IQ and goofy little handle cup ears. And as he's walking there, as you say, Jen, he doesn't even have a village. And so now he's experiencing, in other words, that social rejection. It's actually quite unfair in all kinds of things. They're not, you know, they aren't judging him in any kind of totality with any kind of understanding of who the hell he is. And so we don't even care that he's secretly powerful. Just the fact that he's being rejected, even if he wasn't secretly powerful, would be sort of a rough thing for anybody to have to get feedback that you're of no value to this village at all. But you can imagine what happens then to that kid 2 hours later at the end of school when he goes and joins his other friends in the math team. And it's like, okay, now I'm accepted in the village. Now my strengths are being seen. We can imagine inside of his head and his nervous system rating his inherent feeling of self-confidence in that moment. It's dramatically different than it was in the lunchroom. So that's what you're kind of looking at. So I think the useful thing here is to be thinking, you know, several comments here, as Jen was saying, a whole bunch of this is only an unnatural set of stuff that would take place in the modern world that would have never taken place in the Stone Age. But obviously the feelings that are coming up would be derivatives of Stone Age process, like, for example, being non-competitive. Okay, that is a rough feeling. And then also being non-competitive, but because it's being unfairly judged, that would also then cause feelings of anger and, you know, et cetera. So yeah, I think more than some kind of version where this gets turned back onto us with a disgust about the self, I can see that people could be frustrated with their limitations and the things that are causing them to be rejected by others. I think probably most of us have felt things like that, and it would be a matter of degree. You can have you know, attractive people that are, you know, frustrated with their ears or their hair or their build or their body or their, you know, their voice or their laugh. In other words, there's things that we are aware of that make us less competitive. And sometimes people can be very obsessive and you know, self-critical and frustrated that, that this is how they are, okay? But that's not the same thing as some kind of a global self-disgust, I don't think. Yeah. Anyway, I think we got it more or less right. Does it feel about right?
Yeah. I mean, there's many different little tendrils of the question that we could follow, but I think that basically sums it up.
Wonderful.
Jen Hawk. Yeah. I've never used the word tendrils in my life. This rolls right out of her tongue. along with the nagriel. I can't imagine even to say it. Quit trying.
Tendrils isn't even like a GRE word. That's just a chick word.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. Our next question. By the way, this last those answers you guys gave, it reminds me, I just recently saw a movie called Devotion. It's about, it's set in, I believe, in World War I or World War II. And actually it was about the Korean War, I'm sorry. And it tells the story of an all white flying squadron, and then there's a black guy who is one of the pilots as well. And
I saw a trailer for this.
Very well done movie. I didn't know what I didn't know going into it what it was about. But this this pilot, they go out before they have their actual mission in war. And he gets approached by another squadron that are clearly racist towards him. That's how they're portraying it. They're saying, oh, this guy shouldn't be, you know, part of this, whatever. They get in a fight. And then later on in the movie, that was the ground battalion that was being all racist towards him. And he flies by them and bombs the enemies. And all of a sudden they're like, they love him. They want to go save him when he gets stuck. So it's like, just like you said, if you demonstrate value, if you're actually valuable to the village, then I guess they can overlook that.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be your belonging in any community, whether you have racial differences or any other kind of difference that is preventing you from being quote unquote accepted. It's always, there's going to be a continuum of demonstrating your value to gain that acceptance. So yeah. Yeah. But again, that would be a very strange Stone Age scenario where you've just got, you know, somebody who comes in and walks a little different, talks a little different, you know, looks a little different, kind of makes you nervous and on edge, but is not, you know, that would be an outsider from the start under those circumstances.
Yep.
All right. Our next question.
What else we got?
Doctors, what is the psychology behind interrupting people in conversation? I've read that we're wired to tie up.
You know, what are you talking about there? What are you saying there?
I've read that we're wired to tie up loose ends, meaning that it feels good to tie up a thought that may get forgotten about or change as the conversation carries on. But what do you think most people really, also, do you think most people really listen to what we are saying, or are they just waiting for their turn to speak?
Yeah, individual differences, individual differences, individual differences.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who absolutely, I mean, you can tell. I've had this really interesting experience in sobriety where I find it impossible to hang out around people who are drinking, not because the alcohol is a temptation, but because I find people who are drunk so insufferable because they hear nothing that you say. They are completely speaking in this very performative way, and they're talking only to be heard, and they're generally repeating their stories. But as the sober person among drunk people, it's almost like you can literally see the words go in one ear and out the other. And so it contributes to this real feeling of futility and invisibility in that sort of environment. And obviously there are people like that. They don't have to be drinking to be that kind of blowhard. You know, there are definitely people out there, typically disagreeable people, who are totally talking to hear themselves talk and are not only not pausing to let anybody weigh in on the conversation, but also not hearing anything that is said in the downtime. They're absolutely preparing their rejoinder.
Yeah. It's all personality. The yet people were having conversations. The reason why you have conversations is that there's some kind of value for doing one of two things. You're either mining information out of their head, in a sense, one of that information might be that you're going to make a deal with them in some way, or you are attempting to impact what it is that they think. You're trying to actually, you're either trying to get information out of their head or you're trying to put information in it. And so that's the entire point of the thing. So we can, one of the things that people are seeking in conversation is they're seeking, we could actually make a taxonomy of what it is that they would be seeking, but one of the things that they're going to be seeking is they're going to be seeking esteem from the listener. And so the, obviously, so let's face it, if I go out on a date and I'm talking, there's a reason why I'm doing all that talking, okay?
There's a reason. It's known as the Doug Download, copyrighted.
Okay, so this is, so that's esteem-seeking behavior. And so I guess they talked about interrupting. Interrupting, I've actually seen interrupting from people who do that because they've got some concentrational deficits, and you know they're sort of littered with some OCD circuits, and so they are they're trying to keep track of everything, and it's getting a little too complicated for them. So, but that's not typical. That's an oddball brain where that would happen. Almost always, when this is happening, it's because they're disagreeable, impulsive, dominance hierarchy. They just can't stand it. They cannot stand to sit back and listen. Obviously, you see a lot of interrupting under conflict, but that's a different aspect yet, when people are essentially trying to short circuit the other person's argument and undermine their credibility in the village for what is in fact a dispute that is looking to be heard by nearby bystanders and then be voted on as to who's right. That's why people raise voices, and that's why they get incredibly ingenious about going for the jugular in order to undermine the other person's credibility. So that's obviously instinctual capabilities that are inside of people to do that. So we can see that arguments are not sort of fairly dispassionate discussions about where it is that we disagree about the facts. There are in fact contests where there is where there are resources on the line, and the game, the way to play the game is to play to win, and that means doing anything we can to maneuver. And one of those things is going to be to interrupt people before they can make their point and talk over them, and talk louder and essentially dominate the communication. So, but I think that's not kind of what this person's talking about. This person's talking about why do people, are they anxious and they to get the thought, or some of it, I think a lot of it is more disagreeable people that don't have a lot of impulse control, you know, just have to go in and get that every nugget of status that they can get out of the transaction. I think that is the most common thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, there are lots of different reasons that you interrupt in conversation, and they're not only subject to individual differences, but they're also subject to the dynamic of the relationship. So, mm-hmm. Usually if I interrupt you,
yes,
it's because we are working through a problem together, mm-hmm. trying to figure something out, and you're chasing some thought, and I see I have something relevant to contribute to that thought in that moment. And if I sit on it for another 2 minutes while you wind up
10 minutes,
you know, up there, let's be real, 10 minutes. I'm going to lose it,
yep.
For one thing. I'm not going to quite remember what it was that could contribute to the something that is greater than the sum of its parts in
yes.
the course of that conversation. And so I will say, hold on. There's this thing that's relevant to this. It's in part, yes, I'm trying to get status in the conversation like everybody is in conversation all the time, but I'm also trying to improve our collective effort in some way. So maybe that's an overly charitable interpretation of what I'm doing, but I think at least some of the time that's what I'm up to.
I would say that that's, in my recollection, it's 100% of the time. Like my recollection is, in other words, any status seeking is so far buried into the just general matrix of human behavior. It's nowhere near the top of that pile. That is it. Like whenever you interrupt me, my reaction is, "Ooh, be quiet. This is important." You know what I mean? Yeah, because it is. In other words, I know you're on to something, and I know exactly what that process is. Yeah.
Yeah, but no it doubt. Is that is a dynamic that evolves over the course of building up trust and rapport in a given relationship. So you don't come out of the gate interrupting somebody like that and having and expecting them to have that reaction to it. You know, and I would have the same reaction if most of the time if you interrupt me unless it's a basketball story.
Right. So, in that case.
But this is something that it's unique to the dynamic between two people. So I have other interruption arrangements with other people that look different. And because the dynamics of the relationship are very different, even though we might still be in a joint problem solving enterprise, it just doesn't have the same sort of cadence to it.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. God, what a mind over there. All right, let's go ahead, Nathan. What else we got?
Ego trapping me to quit while we're ahead. We're done here.
All right, Nathan, what else we got?
Dear doctors, can neuroplasticity be used to change personality or...
No.
Next.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Nathan. Sorry
or is it that the DNA remains the same, thus the way new neurons and connections form is also predetermined?
Okay, let me explain this. I mean, I'm sure I've explained it before, probably not 20 times, but certainly 7 or 8 times.
No,
okay.
I think at least 20.
20 times,
definitely
okay.
Been over. So, yeah. So, but it's okay. This is a evergreen sort of topic.
Right. Okay. So the way what changes in your brain, there's effectively a good way to look at your brain is to look at it as if it had three parts. Three huge functions. Okay, one of them is going to be current sensory information and that sensory information is going to be hitting a universal value system, and you're going to be essentially everything that you have sensory awareness of. You're going to be computing the cost benefit of all different alternative courses of action that you could take with respect to that sensory information. So you could be standing on a building in Sacramento, you know, on the 7th floor and look out at the mountains and think, gee, I'd really like to be up at the mountains in the snow. Okay. And then meanwhile, your stomach could be growling and you could look down and you could see this, you know, veggie burger place. You know, I'm just saying it's a veggie burger, but it's probably a McDonald's. And you could say, well, I could go down there. Okay. And then there's that potential mate that's on the floor down below that you could stop by that person's office and flirt with them, okay? So you're actually, that would be an error because that would actually be memory. That would not be direct sensory information. The direct sensory information would be just what it is that you can see, hear, feel, touch, etc., smell. All right, so your brain is computing the value of those things, and then what it does is it brings in memory systems to enhance the accuracy of the cost-benefit analysis that would be taking place just as a result of the sensory data, independent of all other data. Now, the truth is that you're not going to have many sensory experiences in this life that have any significance at all unless it is also incorporating all memory data as well. So the... this gets to be like my mother wakes up and with Alzheimer's and isn't sure where she is and feels very anxious about it. Doesn't know that this is her home. Doesn't know, you know, who's in the home. Doesn't know, you know, can't remember what time of day it is. Can't remember whether she's eaten. All of these things are fascinating and a little bit heartbreaking because she'll wake up very anxious, not knowing where she is, where the bathroom is, what she's doing there, etc. And so essentially what I have to do is I have to reorient her. So I have to bring her new information again, and we get a little bit of information in very, very short-term memory. She can get reoriented, okay? Now, this is the memory is unbelievably important to understand the motivation of an organism. If that rabbit, you know, forages around in a meadow for 3 hours and finally finds the carrots, when it wakes up tomorrow morning, it goes right to where the carrots are. It doesn't have to forage for 3 hours again to find the carrots. Memory systems are unbelievably important enhancements as to what they're an enhancement to the sensory evidence. So two databases, the sensory evidence and your memory, those things feed into the universal value system, and thereby gets calculated the cost-benefit analysis on that will determine what you feel and what you will do. Okay? That is that cost-benefit analysis. That's what we call thinking. Now, the concept in much of psychology is that your, quote, personality is halfway determined, partly, a little bit maybe, or maybe if we're talking about most of the history of psychology, they're going to be thinking that it's not at all determined by your genetics, that in fact it's determined by your, quote, the sum total of the experiences that you've been through. That's what everybody thought, okay? However, the thing is that they were completely wrong. Your personality is going to be completely genetic. That is going to be the way that your universal value system is particularly organized. That's what personality is. Do you like a bunch of adventures? Do you like to see new things, do new things, meet new people, you know, taste new food? That's part of your universal value system about how optimistic you are about new stimuli and whether or not it's worth seeking it out. Okay? How much do you like, you know, spicy food or whatever? We could go through a whole bunch of different stuff. This is clearly that value system that is built into the system already. It's built in with high, very, very tight parameters per species. In other words, everybody the same species values almost exactly the same things. The very, very subtle differences between there are going to be differences largely attributable to the genetic code and entirely to the genetic code with respect to the universal value system, i.e. your personality. Now, but remember, your experiences are a set of data that is coming into this computation at all times. So this is where, as Jen would say, this is... You're having one conversation with one person that interrupts you in a certain way. That's who it is that they are. Over here, we have a different relationship. So therefore, what I'm feeling and how I'm acting in a given situation can be quite a bit different because the environmental circumstances are different. And in fact, it doesn't even have to unfold on me. I can remember, oh, this guy's a disagreeable ass. I'm already ready for it. Okay, my brain's already churning and getting ready for a combative process. Before I even start the conversation with him, I'm expecting it. Okay, and I wouldn't have expected had I not had memory data in there, knowing that this is very likely to happen because this is a repetitive pattern with this personality. Okay, so would we say, well, has my personality changed? Because every time at 4 o'clock on every Thursday when I have to meet with this SOB, I'm getting all hostile. No, that's not a personality change. That's an environmental context change. And the only thing that has happened when I didn't work here before and I didn't have fights with anybody at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday, that it isn't that my personality's changed, my circumstances have changed. Okay, now, so the concept that you can see why people would think that personality would change because they can see changes in people's characteristic patterns of behavior under certain circumstances, you know, in certain lives. But if you step back and look broad spectrum at a human being, it is actually unbelievably obvious that personalities never change. It's actually incredible. I can't even believe that I worked and lived and have lived my academic and professional life in a field that actually believes that personalities can be changed. I can't, it's hard to believe anybody thinks so. It's so obvious to me now that I see clearly, as an apparent, right? They don't change at all. Yeah. The only thing that changes is the memory systems inside the person that helps them potentially have a more, have a different probability of what they think they're seeing in the environment. That's all. Okay, so a person that has a poker player that has lost, you know, done poorly the last seven tournaments in a row, kind of by kind of bad luck and maybe some little bit desperate decision making, is feeling trepidation coming into tournament number eight. Okay, but he's still there. He goes in there, he plays, does pretty well. Tournament number nine, he's a little bit more optimistic. Now, suppose he wins. How do we think he feels going into tournament number 10? Way more optimistic, right? We haven't changed his personality at all. All we've done is changed his estimation of the environment that he's entering based on his experiences. Absolutely nothing about this personality has changed. Okay, so yeah, I will, the closest thing that I know of to our position, I think, and I think Jen agrees with me on this. I think she's been staring at the same data and the same inner, you know, memory data in her own head, as well as Robert Plowman, staring at this thing saying, if you can't find a single environmental variable in the entire history of social ecology research that accounts for more than 1% of the variance in anything that you ever look at, how the hell would you ever think that any environmental variable is ever changing anybody's personality? It's clearly not. Okay. And then you sit back and you look at your friends, and if you've lived long enough, you know, if you met Alan Goldhammer when the two of you were eight, and now we're in our 60s, it's like, guess what, people? I'm telling you right now, there is nothing that has changed. Okay. Think about going home and visiting your mom for Thanksgiving. Really? You know? You're 50 years old. You've known your mom a long time. Has she changed? No, she's gotten older. Her circumstances have changed. Okay. But the only changes that I think you're ever really going to see in personality will effectively be genetic changes as a result of age. So a guy gets older, less testosteronized. Now he's got less fight in him. Okay. He's got less fight at 55 than he did at 25. Okay. That's not a... You know, that's not something that he learned. That was biological changes took place, as well as circumstantial changes took place. Those things, but the biological changes that took place are what? They are genetic. Okay, so anyway, it's a long diatribe. Jen, what do you think about that?
Yeah, this is why we haven't used the term in a long time, but we used to talk all the time about Groundhog Day as this kind of meme to explain your interactions in any given relationship and also your own life. You know, mm-hmm. your life is consistent and your relationships are more or less consistent, absent external factors, because people are so stable and personalities are so stable. And so therefore, the dynamic within the relationship between two stable personalities is a stable dynamic. So Alan is a exemplar. Alan's really, because of his emotional stability, as he acquires new knowledge and integrates it you know, is less likely to affect the way that he lives his life day to day. So he looks more consistent than some of the rest of us do, but everybody's experiencing the same sort of process. He just looks more unchangeable.
Inviolate. Yeah. But yeah, it's funny to me. I guess I was struck by this sometime in the last month. I can't remember why, but it's so obvious that these people are just who they are. You know, it's like it's that's who they are. It's just the essence of them is the same, and they learn things. And sometimes they learn the wrong things. In other words, sometimes they believe something that isn't true, and then they make some mistakes behind that. So it's not like we can't just say, oh, you learn and you grow. It's like, no, well, sometimes you learn and regress. There's no in principle reason why some information that you believe to be true today is worse and less correct than the information that you believed to be true yesterday. Okay, it was just convincing, but it doesn't mean that it's true. And so, but in principle, your life experience is going to be one of being able to record the outcomes of different kinds of hypotheses and change your mind and get more accurate. Okay, so you know, some guy that you thought was a great guy, it turns out 6 months later, you're thinking he's not such a great guy, and a year later, you're out of there. Okay, you aren't wrong now, and what wasn't, you know, in other words, you were right before and you're wrong now. No, more information generally leads you finally to better decision making because your brain is designed that way. It's designed to record, compare, contrast, run experiments, test hypotheses. That's how it's built. Okay, and so in general, you're older and wiser, you know, when you're 55 than when you're 25. But, you know, they have a saying, there's no fool like an old fool. It's like...
Yeah. Well, this is, whenever this comes up, there's always this other layer of, it's a really interesting thing to think about. It's part of what makes it so difficult to understand Plowman, even for those of us who spend a lot of time, you know, reading over Plowman and attempting to understand him, is the kind of this endogenous factor of your openness to experience. There are other things, but openness is so important in acquiring that new information. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have a lot of openness and you've got bad information that you're working with that is affecting your interpretation of how the world works and how relationships work and what everything looks like out there. And you never sort of step into the path of additional wisdom to correct you on that, whether it's through a conversation with a therapist or a conversation with a bartender or additional relationships that are going to overwrite your distortion, then you're more likely to stay in that particular groove. And so you were, you know, less outwardly changing than someone else might be. And that's like a very difficult, it's sort of these factors that are also innate to your personality determine the lifelong implications of that personality and how new information bears upon your ability to integrate it. It's a difficult thing to disentangle from itself.
Yes, fascinating. Yeah. I actually, just as an aside, as you say that, Jen, I find myself battling with what I know is the limitations of my openness.
Yeah.
So I know inherently I'm, God knows, 30 or 40 percentile less open than you are. And so, you know, if you're 80, I'm probably 40 or something like that. We're not way at the other end of the scale, but there's a difference there. And so I know that I'm inherently more rejecting of new information. You know, it makes me, I'm more inherently conservative, sort of by nature there. And I'm aware that sometimes I get that creepy feeling that, hey, you could be missing something, you know? And I find this sort of argumentative, resistant, energy conserving, i.e. the personality of not being optimistic that it's going to be worth it, which is effectively not that open. And so that's one of the reasons why, I mean, there's many reasons, but one of the reasons why it's been super good to be a team with you is that I know effectively in so many ways you cover a lot more ground. You know, you have greater intellectual openness. And so when I hear that you've rejected some hypotheses in a domain, I can relax. Like, oh, you know. I don't have to consider that. You know what I mean?
Except you can't really relax because my openness never allows me to firmly, completely shut the door on anything. So it's like the case is closed for now.
Yeah, right.
Until or unless, you know, there's something that comes along and is more convincing. So yeah, it is. And I mean, I always make this point because I credit it so much with my own so-called resilience. So this is another common question people ask: what determines resilience and what makes people resilient? So, you know, you can grow up, as I did, in a very sort of unusual childhood environment in a lot of ways that contributed to a fair amount of distortion in both myself and my brother. But we're both very open and we both went out there sort of like grabbing new experiences with both paws and trying to triangulate what it was that we perceived about the world and try to get better at assessing how accurate that was and therefore how useful our strategies for navigating the world were. And people who had somebody who had similar childhood experiences who maybe didn't have that kind of openness and intrinsic optimism that comes along with it is in a very different position than we both were. So I'm very grateful for that. But but that itself is genetic. It's not as if that is, you know, I don't get any credit for that. So it's a tough knot.
Yeah, some of the better books and more enlightening books that I've read came as a result of our friend from India.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because he's super open.
And he's very much a polymath, you know. Yes. He just knows a little bit about a lot of things.
Right.
And so, yeah, he is very useful for stimulating all kinds of new conversations and connections. And, oh, I never looked at it from that perspective. And then, as you are with me, he's that many more degrees more open than I am. And so occasionally I'm like, oh, geez, that's crazy. Like, what? Okay. You've gone too far, sir.
Yeah.
So I know the feeling. It just takes a lot more craziness for me to get there.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. All right, Nathan. Well, I think that's probably enough for one day.
Nathan's like, what's wrong with both of you?
I was trying really hard. No, I was just trying hard not to interrupt. And, you know, the couple times I interrupted Dr. Lyle a few years ago, one listener actually called in and was like, Nate, stop interrupting Dr. Lyle.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I get criticized for interrupting Doug all the time. It's that I should sit back and be more respectful of his, you know.
Unbelievable. That's great.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, great to hear everybody's voice. And let's see what else. And we got, pretty soon. Well, what's that? We're sitting next time around. I can't remember. The next time we speak, we'll probably be, I guess we'll probably talk before Christmas, but maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Mm-hmm. Getting close. Yeah. Okay.
I think it'll be real close there.
Probably be the day after something.
Yeah, it's probably going to be the day after, but we're going to release some episodes until then. But for all of our listeners, just in case you skip through the intro part, and to get straight to the questions, because you didn't like the small talk, go to true2life.us to sign up for the seminar that Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk are going to be doing in February 19th of next year.
And Nathan's going to be there.
Looking forward to that.
Nathan will be there.
Nathan's going to come. You got
it'll be a lot of fun.
So
there or something. Yeah. I don't know.
And we're going to meet some new friends. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah.
And like we said, if you missed it before, because it's not possibly entirely clear from the registration page, the in-person spaces are filled up, although I think you could possibly contact Doug if you want to be on the waiting list. Is that is that a thing, Doug?
Sure.
Do we still have room on the waiting list? I know we're...
We
had a lot more interest than we thought we would.
We really don't have room on the waiting list, I don't believe. So,
We will do this again.
We're going to do it again. You know, you bet.
And so it's all, you know, but yeah, you can get your virtual streaming pass, and it's $19.95. That's how much we're charging for it. I don't think we mentioned that before either. So,
got it.
So true2life.us. It's also linked from my website. If you have trouble finding that website, just go to jenhawk.com. It's on the front page there too. So,
fabulous. Yeah. All right.
Wonderful.
All right, everybody. Well, great talking to you. Thank you, Nathan.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful night. And Jen, hopefully your dogs are doing well in the cold. Yeah. And Mo and Melville are doing well.
Mo and Melville and Princess and Lucy. And also don't forget the guinea pigs. We've got
Rosie, we did hear the guinea pigs
Rosie
today.
And Chickpea and Turtlebean and Norman.
So God.
The full menagerie as it currently stands.
Cheaper by the dozen.
Yeah, you got it. Well said. All right, everybody.
Guinea pigs make good compost. Excellent garden compost.
Great. Lovely. Can't wait to visit.
All right. Talk to you next time.
Right, I'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.